When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Hey, if you like our other podcast, Wag the Doug, and I don't know, if you're curious if regional podcasting in Canada can be like a sustainable going concern, you now have the ability to support that show directly with $5 a month. And if we get enough people doing that, that show's going to move from monthly to biweekly, and we'll have a whole new way of making podcasts work. So just go to wagthedoug.com to sign up for $5 Canadian a month for a show that holds Premier Doug Ford accountable. Go do it. There's a code of silence in newsrooms, and this summer it broke. We were never supposed to know about all of the big and small ways in which racism shapes the news that gets reported. Rank-and-file journalists are supposed to keep that stuff to themselves. But now we know. A CBC journalist, a woman of color, returns from covering street protests in Baltimore in 2015 with quotes from black men about their encounters with the police. Her boss won't let her use the quotes on the air because she can't prove that the names the men gave her are real. It's a standard that she has never been asked to meet before. After 5 years of silence, she goes public with the anecdote. A group of 12 global news journalists send an internal complaint to management about a global news story on the Black Lives Matter protests. The story looked at the protests, which it called riots, from the perspective of white Canadians living in the U.S. who felt uncomfortable with them and who called them a, quote, improper way to protest. Global News Management says it will try to do better on diversity, and then weeks later lays off six of the journalists who complained. The National Post runs a piece by a marquee columnist denying that Canada is a racist country, written from the columnist's perspective as a 73-year-old white man and citing no evidence. After newsroom employees complain, management concedes in an internal town hall meeting that the piece was, quote, indefensible and a, quote, fuck-up. An audio recording of that meeting is then leaked to a rival news source. And over at the Toronto Star just last week, in response to this summer of racial reckoning in newsrooms, Toronto Star management announces the creation of a new role, an internal ombud, whose job it will be to field concerns from Black, Indigenous, and other racialized newsroom employees when they have concerns about editorial-related discrimination and bias. And when that new role is announced, marquee columnist Rosie DiMano writes an email calling that role a, quote, fucking abomination that she will not submit to. And she then sends that email to every single Toronto Star employee. It soon leaks, and after that, 62 Toronto Star journalists sign a letter decrying DiMano's email as reprehensible and racist, and decrying DiMano as a bully who has degraded her colleagues for years. That too leaks, and is published by us. The other stories I mentioned were reported in The Walrus by Pasint Matar and in Vice by Manisha Krishnan, respectively. We asked Rosie DiMano if she wanted to comment to us, and she said, nah, but thanks for asking. But the Star's new internal ombud, Shri Parodkar, is going to join me in a minute. Shri is also a well-known Toronto Star columnist who's been writing about race and gender for years. She's worked as a journalist in Bangalore, Mumbai, and Singapore, as well as Toronto. And she wrote a book called Betrayed, My Cousin's Wrongful Conviction for the Murder of Her Daughter, Arushi. Wait for it. This episode is brought to you by Ian William, Carolina Fernandez-Diaz, Colin McCone, Mel Taylor, Gord Morgan, Christopher Heineman, Samantha Hogg, and Brent.
Hello, my name is Brent. I'm an education student from Edmonton, and I support Canalan because the reporting and shows you guys do are excellent. I especially enjoyed the Thunder Bay series and the Canalan Common series on the pandemic in our nursing homes, and it really helps me keep track of what's going on in Canada because I tend to focus at staring at the dumpster fire south of the border. Keep on doing what you're doing.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. I really appreciate you finding time to chat.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, I'm supposed to be on vacation, but this week that's been a little bit of a pipe dream.
Well, I'm sorry for our role in resting you from your vacation.
That's okay. I might as well. Hey.
Yeah, I have a feeling it was gonna get interrupted anyhow. So.
Exactly.
Congrats on the new gig.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
What is an internal ombud? I don't think I've ever heard of that. I mean, I've heard of an ombudsperson at the CBC and other media organizations, which is a variant on the public editor, but that's not exactly what is this role? Can you describe it to me?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that it's probably the first in Canada to, you know, which is why you may not have heard of it. It's not a public editor job, but much more of internal for staff who've been traditionally unheard, which basically means Black, Indigenous, people of color, the few, I should say. It could be, women in different positions. It could be people with disabilities. Anyway, people who are not typically heard or valued to have a safe space, because it's the most marginalized who have the most accurate view of what's wrong or how skewed our coverage is. In an ideal newsroom, all of this would exist. But I think this is the Toronto Star and hopefully other media now starting to accept that this is not a reality for many of the marginalized people in their own newsrooms. And so they've created this position where, because I am also a union person, I have enough seniority, you know, I can maybe be a bit of a buffer, or I can advise them what to do. I know the newsroom well enough. Instead of going directly to the manager, they can come to me. They can go to the manager directly, and that's fine. And I'll continue to do my column. But if they don't feel comfortable, then they have someone else they can come to and not face any reprisals.
What's an example of a case that would require your attention?
Say we have, for instance, and I'm just pulling this out of my hat. I'm not saying it actually exists. Let's say there's a story that there's a rapper, let's say, you know, who's been shot, or there is some violence around that. Mm-hmm. And you have a story, and that has one side, you know, that tells you the police side of the story. And maybe there's a reporter who's already written just the rapper side. And now they've done a follow-up story, which has the police side, and not put the two sides together. For most people reading it, they may not know that this other side already exists. And they're only going to read this police statement, and it's going to look, you know, assuming it's a Black rapper, it's going to start looking like it's an anti-Black story because it's giving an institutional point of view and it's not balanced out. If there is somebody in the newsroom that says, oh my God, this is a problem, and I don't know whom to reach out to, they might tell me, and I would have the authority, if it is online, to say, hey, pull it back for a sec, let's work on that, you know. And I would also just call the digital editor, the assigning editor, and let them know what's going on.
So you would have the authority to hold the piece back?
Not hold. Do you mean when it's online?
This was unclear from the announcements. What are the powers of this role? What can you do? You've said it's a safe space for people who are marginalized or unheard to come and talk. The idea is that this will have an impact on workplace situations and on the editorial content. So what specific powers do you have to work with?
Power is an interesting place to go to. You know, look, we talk a lot about decolonizing. And one of the main tenets of decolonizing even our newsroom, and this is something we've learned from our, you know, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit leaders, is you're sharing power. Less, you know, that I'm this independent place of power that people can come to and I will make things happen. More, what do you need happening and how can I enable you so that you are heard? So that's a subtle difference. In terms of power, the only, like, you know, in how we understand it, in terms of, I think, authority is maybe what you're asking. Mm-hmm. I would say the only place where I would maybe directly just say, hey, pull that back, is if something's on social media, for instance, and somebody from the office points it out to me internally saying, hey, this is a problematic tweet, this is a problematic headline, it's online, and I might just, and if it's truly so and I'm there, I might be able to tell the homepage editors, hey, can you pull that back? But if there is a problem in, say, how a story has been assigned and the reporter has a problem with that, then I would just tell the assignment editor that there is a problem with a story, or, hey, do you want to consider these other options? And then maybe if we have a quarterly review, maybe have like a list of things where we went wrong, what we've learned. Since nobody has done this before, this is going to be a lot of learning as we go. But a safe place for learning that, so that there are no reprisals and there's no awkwardness. Because race as a subject or discrimination as a topic is so loaded and so sensitive that it'll be good to know that, yeah, you can discuss those issues freely without worrying about somebody's defensiveness or fragility.
Whose idea was this role?
I got it from the CBC. I think their Media Guild had a demand for the management. One of those demands was we need to have an internal ombud. And so I took it to Irene. But as it turned out, Irene, a few weeks ago, which I, unbeknownst to me, had floated an idea of having someone in an advisory capacity. And she was thinking of someone external so that it's not one of the managers at the Star. And she recognized, I think, that I would have the trust of our staff as well. So then we went back and forth, hammered out some of the detail, you know, explicitly stating no reprisals, things like that, because I want to make sure that I build in protections for people who do come forward. And also, you know, have the option to walk out if I really need to, because again, I'm also of an identity that's, I'm not Black and I'm not First Nations Métis Inuit, so I'm not as marginalized, but I still have some glass ceilings.
Have you been doing this informally anyhow for a while?
I was.
There's a whole dialogue about how the labor of trying to finally address racism in newsrooms itself becomes kind of distributed in a racist way. You're continuing your column as you take on this new role. Are you getting paid more for doing this new thing?
The union has this kind of a thing in the agreement that you can take on like an acting manager role, and there's like some differential for that role that you get. So yeah, based on our union agreement, I'll be getting whatever the terms are there.
Okay.
But more than the pay, it's that we now acknowledge that it's taking time as well. Now I'm hoping that it means I don't have to do Saturday, Sunday or late nights or early mornings. I'm hoping it means that now I can say, okay, it's one whole weekday right now. So I'm hoping that I can get some time back so that I can also be there for my family.
So Sri, I immediately understood this role when it was announced, and I thought it was actually, to the star's credit, and a good idea. There's another way of looking at this is essentially that this is a pressure release valve. We don't want to read our reporters publicly calling us out. We're going to create a safe space for them to go and be heard, but we're not going to give this person any specific authority. And for all of the nice talk about sharing power, a newsroom is like a dictatorship, and there is a strict hierarchy of who can make decisions and who trumps who. And we're not going to give this person any specific powers. And this is kind of common to the public editor role or the ombuds role in a lot of organizations. It's looked at as sort of a something for management's sake more than for either the reader or staff. You know, something must be done. We did something. Something has been done.
It's really cynical.
Thank you. I tried.
But yeah, I mean, that's why Irene Gentle and I had all that back and forth, because I wasn't born yesterday and I don't want it to be just a checkbox. I'm going to go out on a limb and say neither does she, without, you know, just based on our interaction. So I don't think there's any point wasting anybody's time with a checkbox arrangement here, which is what I think what you're saying comes down to. In terms of power, I mean, I don't understand. There's a part of me that doesn't actually understand the lure of what that power would mean. Power to do what? You know, like I'm not interested in hiring and firing people. I'm not interested in shaming and blaming people. But I am interested in a newsroom that will reflect all the various communities, but that will also center around Black people and Indigenous people, right? And that will center around not just reflecting the struggles and celebrations of these people, but also make sure that we have Black people and Indigenous people in the newsroom, mm-hmm. and make sure that we have a newsroom that is safe for them, that is friendly, that will also promote them, that will value them, right? That's the biggest thing. The biggest change in all newsrooms right now has to be understanding all the racist assumptions that we've carried in our decision-making and start valuing people, non-white people, as equal.
Now, there is a third interpretation of this role, and it's not one that I really would put much stock in as a point of debate, but I think it's a political reality, this third perspective in your specific workplace. And that is that your new role is a fucking abomination. I think that is worthy of your laughter. However, it was something that was sent to every one of your colleagues by the most famous, and I think within this Toronto Star's culture, a very powerful person, and that is Rosie DiMano, who I think, if I'm not reading too much into her email, sees this as a level of micromanagement on her content, something impeding her ability to express herself or something like that, and one that she's very angry about. And as ridiculous as I find that, most specifically because there's nothing about how your role has been described that would suggest that you are going to be editing her copy, it is something that I think a lot of people in the public agree with. Certainly within the Star, you had 62 people sign a letter decrying Rosie DiMano for saying that. But that leaves a lot of people who didn't sign that. And some of them had other reasons that, you know, they might be involved with a union, so they can't go against Rosie if they, you know. But some of those people might agree with her. And it made me wonder, like, wow, this role that Sheree is stepping into might be from the get-go a very divisive place, and the authority of it might be something that is not universally accepted within the newsroom. Like, are you at the center of a coming Toronto Star newsroom culture war?
Ooh, wow. I hadn't thought of it that way at all. Look, there was nobody doing a race and gender column on staff until I did it, right? And that itself, for a lot of people, that itself is a very divisive role. Like, the idea of talking about race at all is considered divisive. Mm-hmm. So none of this is new to me. And I'll tell you, in a general sense, anything to do with racism, anti-oppression, any kind of oppression, whether of sexuality, ability, and all of that, if it didn't have resistance, it wouldn't exist. So by definition, anti-oppression work, equity work, has to have opposition. That is part of the job. I have faced opposition, public opposition, to what I do since the time I began. So I'm not speaking here specifically of a reply all, but I'm saying generally. And so, I mean, it's more of the same.
And what do you make of that position that Rosie took, that this is micromanagement, another layer of it's an abomination that's against the principles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
I mean, look, Jesse, I have a lot of thoughts about that, but everyone's entitled to their opinion. And I think I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one thing I did forget was to voice my protest at you guys for publishing the names of my colleagues who signed on to that letter.
We had a vigorous newsroom debate about whether or not that was what we should do or not. Tell me why we got it wrong.
Because honestly, it's the youngsters. You know, you saw that. There were radio room people there, guys. They were like, you know, people who've just been like there for 3-4 weeks and they've put their names on this. And I'm sure they believed it was an internal document. Whatever. I mean, I know that's naive. And all
you're
of that,
sure that they believed it was an internal document?
Oh, well, I'm going to go in good faith and assume that. There may be one, I'm not saying every single one of them, but I think they would have, you know, just the idea of them being open to public scrutiny to future, you know, people for their careers. Are they going to be seen as troublemakers, marked as troublemakers? And some names are more visible than others, right? Of those journalists mm-hmm. of color, especially. And those are the names that will stick out. Those are typically the names that will be penalized if there is ever any penalty to this. And so that just worried me a little bit. And I thought, you know, it was possible to say that there were 62 journalists, many of whom were, you know, of different seniority levels, different races. And it was wonderful allyship, frankly, wonderful allyship. But I do feel a little bit worried for the youngsters. Yeah.
We worried about that, too. And I think that you make a decent argument for the other side. And ultimately, we had conversations about, well, if we did not feel as supportive as we do towards the sentiments in this letter, would we also hesitate? And also, to the extent that we cover the Canadian media, how much news worth do we put on the names that are included and the names by omission? And might that be a document that in time becomes more and more important? So ultimately, I was definitely on the side of we publish things here and we can't take responsibility for the outcomes, but we can't be oblivious to them either. But it wasn't an easy call. And
yeah. No, I can see why there is some news value to who all signed it, because there's a wonderful story there. I just worry about the consequences for their future in journalism.
I hope there's enough of them and there are senior people there. I hope there won't be any retribution. And that was part of our... Yeah.
But no, I don't believe there will be reprisals, honestly, at the Toronto Star. I just meant in general for their journalistic life, given what we've known of this industry, that I don't want them to have that risk. But hopefully times have changed enough that maybe that's a fear that's misplaced.
You seem so comfortable in a role of opposition that actually you've occupied for a long time. I mean, you know, we don't have to reach for hypotheticals when it comes to race in the Toronto Star. Desmond Cole losing his column, essentially walking away from his column after he was told that he had to choose between being an activist and being a columnist. That you took a position on that, and it was a position against the Star's position.
It was, yeah. That was one. Look, I mean, you know, my very first column, even before the one that I wrote on the Star and Desmond Cole, which I found to be a very unfortunate parting of ways, because I mean, wow, can you imagine if we still had him? What a great and powerful voice that would be.
What an asset the Star could have had this past summer and prior to that.
But anyway, like, you know, and not just, you know, like Desmond has so much to offer, right? There's so much wisdom there. And so, yeah, I think we're all poorer for it that he's not at the Star. But even before that, like my very first column that I wrote as a columnist was about diversity in the media and how the lack of it is a form of oppression. I think I disagreed with my editor-in-chief, that was Michael Cook at the time. And so it was seen as something subversive, but, you know, in a nudge, nudge, wink, wink way. Then by the time I wrote the Desmond column, it was like, oh, really? You're taking this? Oh, my God, you're so brave. And then by the time I did the Maxime Bernier column, which I completely disagreed with having him invited to the editorial board, by that time, there was enough subversiveness in the newsroom that I actually got an internal award that we call the Holy Joe for it. And so, again, you know, not everybody's going to agree. In fact, I'm certain there were people who were, you know, probably rolling their eyes. There might have been. But how can I let that stop me? You know, if I consider the long arc, and don't get me wrong, I sound comfortable right now. Some of this stuff does wear me down. It has its impact. At the same time, you know, if I think of, honestly, and without being too corny, I think of my work and I think of when my kids are older and they read it and their kids read it, will it stand the test of time? Or mm-hmm. are they going to be ashamed? And I'd like to think it would stand that test of time. So then all of these other attacks that may come, opposition that will come, is then to be expected.
Yeah. I mean, you have a very optimistic and sunny disposition towards something that... It sort of describes a wonderful vision of the newspaper as a place that can contain multitudes and withstand a lot of internal contradiction and can have a falling out, you know, with Desmond Cole that you can excoriate them for, but maintain your position there as somebody who can excoriate them from within the pages of the Toronto Star. You've published the details of your exchanges with John Hondrick, the former publisher. You've done things that I think a lot of people who don't feel a lot of power in newsrooms are like, wow, that can be done. And that speaks well of the Star, that for whatever its faults, it can sustain that. I like to think of a newsroom that way. I like to think of a news organization that way. That's, I think, what we do at its best. The Star is complicated, though, and it's hard to just conclude that it all kind of comes out in the wash. Like, people get hurt along the way, and the Star, because it makes such a public commitment to progressive values and to these Atkinson principles, you think about things like your colleague Ravina Alok's suicide, and there is a racialized aspect of that. You think about the experiences that a lot of young women had at the Star and a culture that some of them felt was predatory. There's no simple answer to this, but I guess you're still committed to the project and you still feel like it's a project that can work.
The project of my current job?
The project of the Star's role in a civil society, trying to, I guess, account for its own lapses and shortcomings and ultimately come out as a social good and a social benefit.
My God, yeah. If we didn't have that hope, then why are we doing what we do, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a profound shift afoot in the Toronto Star, but also in, I hope, in Canadian media. I mean, I think of, you know, all these brave, really brave young journalists, Black journalists, Indigenous journalists coming out, speaking against their employers publicly. And it is a risk. Don't get me wrong. Just because, you know, people see things out in the public doesn't mean that people were just, you know, so relaxed and they're just having fun. They're not just relaxed about it. There is a risk. And they don't know. Nobody knows the fallout when they go to, you know, when they attach their name to something that's subversive. But does the star have its flaws? Yes, of course, of course. And that's why I think the idea of having an internal ombud is an acknowledgement of that flaws. Really, by the time you come to a place where you can have an internal ombud, you are saying that we haven't been able to do this on our own, and that's why we need this position. What saddens me deeply is, you know, you referenced some of that earlier with the, you know, young women. Mm-hmm. There have been people across newsrooms in Canada who've had their esteems crushed, decimated because of either, you know, a personality, culture, nepotism, all sorts of things that the media will not tolerate in another industry. We will not tolerate it among politicians, in law, anywhere else, but we will hypocritically enforce ourselves. And, you know, we talk about BIPOC journalists, and a friend of mine who is Black used to be an intern way back, you know, in the late 90s. She had just graduated from journalism school. She's no longer a journalist. Very quickly, she stopped being a journalist. And I never stopped to think about why that was. And even for her, and she and other friends like her, who were women of color, who stopped being journalists, this moment, what happened in the last couple of months, was a moment of not just an acknowledgement, but a deep grief and realization that they actually had internalized the inferiority that this industry had foisted upon them. And so not only did we lose all the stories and the perspectives and the access that these women would have had, but we crushed them in the process. And so I think my job is to make sure that we never, never do that to another Black or Indigenous journalist or a journalist of color in our newsroom. Never have somebody's esteem so crushed that they feel that their stories are not worth telling.
You're taking on a lot. I mean, that's a big job to try to make sure that that never happens again. And you're taking on a lot in terms of being like, if this is a question of representation and your identity does matter for this, you acknowledge this, it's upfront in the way you write about your job. You say that you have a Brahmin privilege. And even in my conversation with you, you want to make it known, you can't speak for Indigenous journalists. You can't speak for Black journalists. The complexities of this are many. It's a big task that you're taking on and putting on your own shoulders.
It is, and I am one person. Somebody, you know, a senior journalist messaged me the other day and said, just remember, you're one person, so don't take on too much. And I won't. I'm going to try to remind myself. I still have a column, so I still have an accountability to the people, and I'm definitely accountable. This is not, I don't have a savior complex here. You know, I am accountable to the principles of racial justice and social justice that I learned from Black leaders and from First Nations, Métis, Inuit leaders, right? So I have to be as accountable. And what I saw in the last few days is, while the role is that I support other people who are marginalized, instead, what has happened is they have come together to support me. And so that is another example of this power that we spoke about, where it's not top down. It's not something that, you know, I'll sit on my throne and dish out my support. It flows in many directions. And it's all needed. You know, everybody has different vulnerabilities, and it's all needed. So I know it sounds, you know, kind of corny, But I'm done with that colonial top-down sort of working style. And I'm hopeful that we have a newsroom where we can just pitch in our ideas. The one tip that I have for all journalists often is, you know, treat every BIPOC journalist who comes your way as if they are Daniel Dale. You know, just pretend they're Daniel Dale. And whatever they're saying, give it the same value that you would do if they were Daniel Dale. And then we might have a fair chance.
There are voices, and a lot of them are younger voices, whose response to all the racial injustice in the Canadian media is burn it all down. What I hear in your analysis is that there's worth to these institutions and they should be reformed, because if you basically throw everything on the garbage pile, we're living in like a post-truth world where it's a scary place.
I'm a big fan of the concept of burn it all down. Where I have a limitation is I don't have the imagination to see the alternative. But that mm-hmm. doesn't mean that other people don't. And when people who say burn it down offer, you know, when they have an alternative vision, I'm all for it. I do feel that the media as a concept of accountability can withstand not just tinkering and, oh, let's just include some, you know, brown faces in white spaces, as it's called, but actually make internal change. I do think it's possible. It's you know, it is possible to make that decolonization within existing structures possible, and then therefore see a radically transformed new space.
The way you describe all these things, it's so complex. In India, you describe yourself as basically white, and then you describe in Canada systems that work for white people only. But in Canada, perhaps you're not basically white. You write, it was my inevitable racialization that led to a profound consciousness of my identity as a non-white person. This evolving awareness led to your current life-defining role as the race and gender columnist. One thing you pick up on Twitter, where I spend too much time, is a lot of people who don't understand how that would be life-defining. People for whom anti-racism in a previous generation was about, like, let's not talk about race so much. Let's not think about race so much. Let's be colorblind. And to hear people saying that that is a life-defining role to be the race and gender columnist. Can you talk about this inevitable racialization?
I understand the people who were colorblind more than they might think, because that's where I was once. I shudder to think of how privileged and blind I was to racism when I first came to Canada. I literally had no idea and assumed, yeah, Martin Luther King did something in the past and everything was okay, and racism is something that happened in the past, which is why it took me so long to understand what was happening to me was racialization. I did internalize a lot of inferiority. How I spoke was inferior, how I dressed was inferior, and I just thought, oh, I just need to change to fit in and everything's going to be okay. If I only wore these clothes and these colors and wore my hair like this and tried to change my accent and, you know, just changed a little bit, then it would all be okay. And then you come to that inevitable point of realization, you're never going to be one of them. And at that point, it's a very painful point where you, you know, to even, if you've never thought of yourself as racialized. I was never South Asian. I was never non-white. Those were not definitions that I just never thought of white and non-white until I came here and until I was forced to think about it, until it was foisted on me. And it takes a hell of a lot of confidence. In my case, as an immigrant, it took me having to go back and to realize, oh, wait a sec, no, I am normal. Nothing's actually wrong with me. Nothing has changed with me. I started to think maybe, you know, health-wise something was wrong. Maybe I had fooled myself all my life. Maybe my confidence was misplaced. And you go through so much trauma and pain all because you're not white. And when you come to the recognition that you are devalued for something as superficial as your skin color, you recognize the lie that is colorblindness. And you recognize who is comforted by the idea of colorblindness. It's only people who don't ever face racism because of their color, their skin color. And so once you recognize it and then you start, in my case, I began to read and follow a lot of Black thought leaders. And truly, it's life-defining because Black feminism and Black learnings put me on a path of liberation. It made me understand why it's important for me to value myself and to stop fitting in. Fitting in was not important. To be authentic was more important. And to be authentic, meaning to own everything, including the uncomfortable bits of my own Brahmin privilege. Once I have this, I don't care how I sound. I don't care if I'm loud and not neutral and, you know, too dark, too light, too whatever. It doesn't matter. I can hold my own because I am somewhat liberated.
There's that word again, though, the uncomfortable parts of your identity, that this discomfort. I mean, that feels like the word of the moment. This is all so uncomfortable, and you can, that discomfort leads to anger for people who just say, stop talking about race already, or, you know, and then there's sort of laughter from the right, watch the left eat its own tail. You know, there's a whole critique amongst right-wing Twitter of institutions like the Toronto Star that is gleeful and mean and mocking, and that makes people uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for all of the journalists who've come forward on Twitter with articles documenting things that, like, they don't want, they wanted to just do their jobs. They don't want to have to call out bosses. It's so uncomfortable for the managers, for the institutions themselves. They had to be dragged kicking and screaming. As an employer, it's been uncomfortable for me. This is uncomfortable stuff. And I think a lot of people have remarked, like, ugh, it's just division and this is hell that we're in. You know, it's just gotten to be so much conflict all the time. And I read your tweet, apropos nothing at all, I'm here to say I love and support young journalists slicing through layers of obfuscation and challenging the old guard on issues of social and racial justice. And the word love there, I think back to when I started Canada Land out of an impulse that, like, there are all these problems that no one's talking about and no one's willing to talk about. Let's get uncomfortable. Let's create a space for people to get uncomfortable. And I didn't know what I was asking for because I ultimately ended up making myself very uncomfortable as well. But ultimately, there's maybe a naive bottom line belief on the part of people like ourselves who've chosen words and communication and reporting and hopefully the pursuit of truth that you gotta love it. You gotta love any shift or change that breaks a silence, right? Like, you gotta love it if people are talking about things that they were afraid to talk about. And as uncomfortable and as painful that is, and I appreciate that it's more painful for some people than others, it's gotta be good, right?
Change has gotta be good, but I do want to juxtaposition discomfort versus the violence of racism, because we know racism kills, right? That's the cost of racism.
Yeah.
And so if, and casteism. And so if on the other side of the ledger is discomfort, then I don't want to spend, honestly, too much time dissecting how that discomfort feels and whether, you know, we can withstand it. It's like, yeah, whatever, just deal with it, because on the other side is utter violence. And the trouble with thinking too much about comfort and discomfort is then we start patting ourselves on the back a little bit, you know, like, see, we were uncomfortable, but we got this done. And that's when we start being happy with incremental change. And that's not acceptable, because meanwhile, mm-hmm. people are dying and 400 years of it, right? And it can't be fast enough, which is why I completely sympathize with the burn it all down, because who's going to wait for incremental change? So the discomfort, the guilt, all of that, accept it, push it aside, move on, act. Right. And this is where. And I say to journalists, you know, do not, for God's sake, we need to stop asking, does racism exist? We need to stop even asking, was what so-and-so said racist, or was it actually not racist? I think just ask, are you coming in the path of anti-racism, or are you enabling anti-racism? And I think that's a simple place to start, so we don't have to worry about, you know, libel and, you know, sensitivity around, is somebody racist? Because that seems to be such a trigger word for white people. Think in terms of anti-racism and that path, and are you in the way or are you helping it?
And I think you're too polite to say what's suggested there, which is, a person like myself should stop patting myself on the back for enduring some discomfort, because the impacts are far, far greater than discomfort. I'll take that. And I guess the last thing I want to contemplate is I have to hold out some hope for incremental change. I think that for a lot of people, and I don't exclude myself from this necessarily, the discomfort is about something else, which is essentially that power is being challenged. And ultimately, it's about power. Privilege as toxic a word as it is really nice to have, and nobody wants to lose it. Right. But, and I think that people are feeling that they're getting rattled, and the positions of privilege are being rattled, and, you know, just giving up a position of privilege is I don't know what the historical precedent is for people just sort of like handing over power and privilege. People fight.
But it won't happen. I mean, nobody's giving up anything. You're really not. Like, how is sharing, like, you know, it's so wrong to think of sharing power as being giving up power. I mean, that's a colonial perspective. Oh my God, if we share, we are going to be weakened, and they will do to us what we've done unto them. You know,
that is the psychology underneath it, is that I think that white people know what's been done, and they know, like, there's a sense of like what justice would look like.
So if you know that, though, if people know that, then that's all the more terrible that they do nothing to stop it, because then let's stop talking about human rights and egalitarianism and all of those fancy things that we use, we meaning, you know, the collective we here, Canadians, use to hold ourselves up as some kind of an exemplar to the rest of the world, and just say, no, that's not at all who we are. Yeah. We are okay with racism and eugenics and the rest of it. We believe we are already there. We are not. So what can we do to make that image that we have of ourselves real? What is the sacrifice that it's going to take? It's going to take us being truthful. It's going to take us being truthful to our historical injustices. I'm not just talking about residential schools, but also treaties, treaty rights, equal funding for First Nations children, and so much. There is so much, every field, right? And which is why there's another pet peeve I have with Canadian media, that we talk about racism because something racist happened. And that's not, you know, racism permeates every sector of what we do. And racism should be a lens that we apply, all of us apply, to every decision. It should not be a separate beat or a separate, now let's talk about racism and let's call these black people and ask them what they think about racism. Like, as if just because you're black, you're supposed to have all the analysis ready because you were just, you know, you have the lived experience, right? There's so many more nuances. We are so racially illiterate, and I wish we would just learn human rights from the get-go, you know, recognize how to bring your identities and be aware of your identities, recognized in the classroom onwards to everything that you do after that. This was the reason I did a whole one-year fellowship in Education Without Oppression, the Atkinson Fellowship last year. The problems start at a very, very young age in Canada.
My last question to you, in 3 to 5 years, what's the best case scenario? Would it be that the role of the internal ombud at the Star lives on and is a recognized part of the way things work? Or would it be that it's no longer necessary?
Ah, the second. I mean, my idea of success would be to have both my roles not needed anymore in Canada. But I don't know if 3 to 5 years is a realistic goal for that.
And if that's the case and your column and the internal ombud role are no longer needed, then what will you do?
What will I do? I don't know. I might go back to editing. I don't know. Who knows? When I decided to become a columnist on this very contentious issue, it was like I had taken a flying leap off a cliff. I knew that, you know, there was no more safety net. I was on my own. Nobody at my workplace had done the job before me. I was going to be navigating something that was going to get everybody's backs up. And I just thought, let it fall where it may. I'm going to go with my conscience. And I just did it. So now it's too late for me to start thinking about plans for myself. All of this is just still leaping off the cliff, wherever it takes me.
That is your Canada Land. If you like this show, help us make it and get ad-free versions of it. Just click on the link in the show notes or go to canadalandshow.com/join. You can do it in seconds. Email me your thoughts about what you just heard if you care to at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I do read everything you send. We're on Twitter at CanadaLand. Our website is at canadalandshow.com, where you can listen to the bold return of Wag the Doug. The senior producer for this episode is Kasia Mihailovic. Our managing editor is Andrea Schmidt. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like what we do, please support us.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.